Okay, then we have that time back for Pat. You're too funny. Well, this is the time that is reserved for questions and answers, for comments, and I think several of you may have some interesting comments. And with whatever time we have left, I have a couple of little stories to tell you about, some morphogenetic field things that I think are kind of springing up here in Santa Barbara. But I'd love to hear from you. Questions, comments. Come on up to the mic, please.
Thank you, Pat, for all that you've shared. I was wondering if you could either invite us to participate in this over-chanting, or if you could give us a little demonstration. I don't want to put you on the spot.
If only I could. However, we have in our midst a couple of people who really know about chanting. Christine, where are you? Yes. Talk to this lady. She knows a lot about it. I cannot produce an overtone myself, but I have learned that that consciousness is quickened and modulated by the vibration of our own sound in our chest. I spent a week with the Monroe Institute people last fall. Don't know if any of you are anybody familiar here with the Monroe Institute. It's a very interesting work that's been going on for, goodness, I guess, almost 50 years on the East Coast. It was started by a radio man who, after the Second World War, I think he was probably an old Signal Corps man, who began putting together spots on local radio and tinkering and repairing the microphones and eventually buying the little station and then buying another little station. And then he eventually had what was something like the, not NBC, but it was almost as big as when NBC bounded together. He had a nice little empire, but he was not as interested in profit only. What he was finding himself interested in was what was happening to him as he was working with sound currents. And he began spontaneously to go out of his body, and that it was sound that began to do it. Robert Monroe is his name. He has written 3 books. He's an extremely intelligent man. He is the guy who wears the plastic in his pocket that you put the pen on top of. He's an engineer, and not likely to move into flights of fancy. So as he read his books, they're wonderful. Far Journeys is one of them. Maybe Ultimate Journey is the next. But at any rate, what he found was that different sound waves match alpha, beta, theta, gamma, etc. He began to work in hospitals. He began to work with psychologists. And eventually, this became the main work that he was doing, and it is what the Monroe Institute now does. Exclusively, it trains people to listen to modulated sound that comes in on either side of the head so that the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, which receive slightly different sounds at slightly different amplitudes, begin to put together the answer to your question about chanting. It rises up into a higher way of functioning across your brain. A lot of interesting things happen with that, but mostly it just begins to deepen one's experience, one's capacity to receive signals, information, and sense instantly what to do with them because you're much more aware of the wholeness of things. Well, it was in that week that I learned that they use chant, not overtone chanting, but chant to really start the process for us. And I had done a lot of sort of taizé chanting and other kinds of chanting, which I've always just loved in the days when I had a voice before I lost my thyroid in a part of my voice box. But I'm going to stand back from the microphone and attempt a halfway answer to the question. I have begun to do this after the Monroe Institute time, and I find that it literally starts my session with meditation or prayer at a different pitch. That you're not, it's an ugly sound. You're not going to like it. But let me just show you what the amplitude feels like for me. That's good. That's it. Just down there and just hold it as long as you can. You'll begin to feel a little quickening. I do it for 7 breaths. I don't know how long that is, but that's as much as my impatient mind is willing to do. And it just sets me. So that vibration begins to work. Chanting to really produce those tones is an art, and it's not one that I can do myself. Yes, Tom.
Yeah, I'll comment a little on that, because those of you who have heard Tibetan Buddhist chant on the symbol Om probably have heard this. They sing in a very deep tone and seek to bring out the overtones, which occur naturally wherever there's a vibrating system. When I play my guitar, you're hearing overtones as well as the fundamental. And sometimes if you coax the string the right way, you will hear the overtones and not the fundamental. In other words, I can make an octave and a fifth, a double octave. I can go on and on and on in this spiral of overtones. But there's something very nice about the saying, Om.
Yes.
You know, just hold that tone and just feel what happens.
Thank you, Tom.
On the same subject, just a little interjection here. Cyprian Consiglio will be coming in a couple of weeks, and it's the monk that does the chanting and the musician. So I will email him and ask him if he can do that for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Judith. You see how things fit together. Thank you.
When you said Don Campbell, I couldn't help but remember. I studied with him for a while. He was teaching a series of classes up in Oakland, and we'd stay in the Holy Cross College, the one that looks over the freeway. He was the first one who ever told me listening to freeway sounds, you just pretend it's the ocean, and it helped a great deal. But he taught this, the chanting through your body. You start with in different places you would emphasize, and you go the ah, e, o. I did it for a year. My kids used to laugh because they'd hear me from downstairs. But it makes a huge difference in how your body functions. And I went from there to a listening and learning class where you had headphones on your ears and you listened to chant or Mozart. I went for that class up to Pasadena where they had a school. And they made huge differences in people's lives. Autistic children who started to respond to parents. A woman who had never spoken in her life. She'd been adopted and 50 years later had never spoken at all, and she started to talk to her mother. I mean, it was just amazing what happened with this opening the ear and going with it. So
thank
it was really quite wonderful.
I am put in mind of some of the therapies for stuttering. Stutterers do not stutter when they sing. Yes. Yes. Hello, Dawn.
Hi. It's sort of hard to frame this, but There's a film that made the circuit some time ago, and it's The Weeping Camel.
Oh, yes.
National Geographic put it out. And I don't want to try to capture the whole of the story, but the camel, who was the mother who was rejecting its baby, was found to be such a serious case that they sent for the violinist. These are people who lived in yurts. In wherever yurts are, you know, Siberia, I guess. And the violinist came and replicated the sort of screechy, violent kind of sounds that the mother was emitting when she was rejecting her baby and would not let the baby nurse. And then you see, as the violinist replicates it, that is, mirrors and echoes back to the mother, a calming. And finally, there's a reuniting. The question I have is that some part of what I'm hearing sounds like always wanting to make beautiful music, like beautiful chanting, you know. And it seems that as a country and as an individual, I sometimes have to listen to discordant music in order to feel heard. You know, like a lot of the music that came out, the classical music of the 20s and 30s, it's hard for me to sit and listen to it. Stravinsky, I don't even know their names because, you know, I go to Mozart when I want to be held. But this kind of music, it seems important, you know, and from this heart math point of view, I'm going to ask you to comment on discordant music as an important part, if it is. Because if not, I get nervous about new agey things and only look at beautiful stuff.
Amen to that. Thanks for the question. Let me back into it by coming at music, which I love, but it's not my first field, through my first field, which it really was the arts. Think back for a moment to, the standard European art of the late 1800s, all wonderful representational paintings that finally sort of had their peak in Ingres and David in Paris, with those super, super realized, realistic paintings. Then remember that something began to happen, and we began to get something that was a little like a holograph effect with the Impressionists, who began just looking at patterns of light that began to work through, I think, that whole collective unconsciousness. Out of that first gentle breaking into a new field of perception and representation, we began to get those first deep discordant notes. In 1904, Ernest Rutherford split the atom. In 1902, I think, Picasso and Braque began putting out their first canvases that began to split the surface. They split teacups, and they would put the handle up on the left and the saucer up on the right and the bowl of the cup down at the bottom. You've seen this work. It was beginning to fracture and come apart at that point in science, in art, and on in music. What happens with cognitive dissonance within the brain is very much like, I think, what happens with these binaural beats coming in on two sides of the head at the Monroe Institute. Eventually, there will be enough resonance so that something new will begin to emerge from it. That's the basis of chaos theory in any event. That's what all these fractals are about. We are all fractals, but that's a subject for another morning together. But it might be fun to take an excursion with fractals along some of these same lines. The point about this overall sort of shattering of the surface of things is that I suspect it was, in fact, a mere precursor to the ultimate shattering and breaking apart that began to arise in the 60s with this huge shift in mores. We're uncomfortable with music and art. How much more uncomfortable are we with watching our culture slowly begin to shift and break apart? What we're relying on to hold it together, of course, are increasingly strong controls from government, increasing jamming together of capital so that it can be shepherded just by fewer and fewer people who will keep a good hand on everything, which is, of course, the exact opposite of what the intelligence of the whole would suggest, which may either end up in cataclysm and then it will begin to self-organize, or there are vortexes of self-organizing activity that are happening everywhere right now in any event that may make a difference. But we are caught in the middle of, who wrote it? The upstart spring, Fry, wasn't it, Christopher Fry? Where the long, static, rigidly held laws of nature and culture reality is finally beginning to thaw and crack and move downstreams on currents of strangeness and newness and consciousness. We're riding our own particular ice floe here, and it's getting smaller all the time. We're probably going, this may in fact be the way we will become the amphibians that we already are. We're not going to climb out, we're going to fall in. So, if that helps put it in context. Yes. Comments, questions.
When you said when we become amphibians again, I had a wedding of a grandson to a Jamaican woman before Christmas. And one of the things set up was to ride the dolphins. And when I got out there and the dolphin came up and I got a hold of its fins, I got so carried away I nearly killed myself. I forgot to let go. It was such a connection and such a vibration was the word. I just felt totally at one with this creature. It was the most, I wouldn't mind going back to being a dolphin. Oh,
thank you, Jenny. See, those gills are coming up in a new way. Well, just in comment, and then please, I want to hear your question or comment. No one has talked about the whales yet in Judy's book, but this is the time to talk about the whales, isn't it? The stranded beached whales who, when this tiny little human person gets the bulk of that animal, how could they possibly know that this person was there except by means of these interlaced fields of intelligence and intention and caring, which are as powerful as the coherent laser light that can burn the hole through the sun 90 million miles away. It's that place we're talking about that must have come into play when the good person went up to the beached whale, gently pressed. How could they even have felt that? But it was transmitted. So, what is, Blake finding a universe in a bit of sand, Bacon's Hound of Heaven, you cannot touch a stone but for the trembling of a star. We've always loved that poetry. Now we can see that it actually happens within the Holoverse, because all of this is shimmering fields of consciousness that is crystallizing into matter, like salt crystals out of brine. That's what we are. And that's what carries the information. Yes, please.
With the strong exception of my wife, Claudia, who's both mystery and a mystic, and the rest of you here, I'm wondering about the people who I normally rub elbows with, who are not this group here, who call him or her Joe Sixpack or Mary Sixpack, the person out there that may never have the chance to be with us here and listen to what Pat's talking about and what we are, this field of compassion that we experience. Something I read, Eckhart Tolle, I think, Alice MacDonald referred to this one time in her talk, he refers to placeholders in the world who aren't necessarily the initiators or the movers of what's happening, but who keep things together along the way. What about Joe Sixpack? Where is Joe or Mary Sixpack in this mystery we're talking about? Does that sound weird?
Oh, no, that's okay. A wonderful question. Okay. Yeah. Well, good old Joe Sixpack, he's a lot easier to sit beside than it is to sit beside, say, a Thomas Berry or a Rupert Sheldrake. He's completely undemanding. When we think about wholes and parts and the role that, say, the skeleton plays as opposed to the role of the eye totally different functions in this whole body, but the skeleton must be there. It must be that structure that holds us together well enough so that we can go adventuring with the eye. Eventually, everything gets felt and wicked in to everything else. But this is an extremely untidy experiment that the presence of God is running here. It's risky and dicey, and this particular version of it may in fact trip and fall. But that's only one version of it, because it'll be picked up by something else, and other things are in fact happening around us that we have no idea about. And it may be that Joe's six-pack is also undergirding some of those pieces as well. Very likely, these are pretty central. This part of the culture is pretty central. Statistically, they're important as stabilizers. All honor to Joe Sixpack. I know him fairly well. And in my family, amongst my friends, and occasionally I've kicked back and felt a real kinship. Thank you. Yeah, very important, I think.
I'm wondering, Pat, if this would be a good time for you to tell us about the healing touch that's going on in several parishes in Santa Barbara.
Thanks, Judith. I was dying to put in a series of slides that showed what happens when a person's hands, through prayer and stillness, are allowed just to become coherent with the whole body system. When heart and brain entrain, and then the intention is dropped in for whatever repair or whatever gentling or help is needed, the hands flare with energy. There's a lot of documentation now about healing hands. We emit a kind of healing rays just when we're coherent. Just being coherent. Remember, the meditators, just 20 minutes, twice a day, were coherent enough to have calmed that spiky energy that would flare into outright violence in D.C. Well, it's that same coherent wave that can be directed to another system, and that is really what healing is about. It isn't that someone has a healing talent. Bosh, what nonsense. There are people who are born so connected in an internal way with the wholeness of themselves and the field that they are coming toward that order just immediately rises out of that chaos we've been talking about, whoosh, and comes together. Very often it's not for the malady that the person thought they were bringing. Something else happens that calms them down that they walk out with. But can also, of course, be designed to do some very specific work. But we all have innately that charged hand that we have used all our lives. How many of you as parents would put a hand on a troubled child and see the whole thing begin to calm down? How many of you put a hand on a spouse's shoulder or befriended an elder? Just holding hands. I cared for my mother-in-law 5 years of Alzheimer's until her death. She had forgotten me about midway. I would put her to bed at night. She would look at me and she'd say, "I've enjoyed my stay at the hotel, but please have the bellboy at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning because I'm going home." And I would say, "Yes, Mrs. McClure, we certainly enjoyed your visit." At the end, Agnes had lost all her moorings. But we would just sit and hold hands, just holding hands. I didn't know in those days, because I was still a young woman, what was going on. But it was enough. It was always enough. The nurse would come and sit beside us sometimes and say, What do you think is really going on there?" And honestly, I didn't know. But I think I do know now. I think that I had moved inadvertently into that place and her heart caught it immediately, and we knew each other in ways that we never had to put a name to, and she was content, and I was content. It is out of that mutuality that healing happens. Between All Saints by the Sea and Trinity Church about 7 years ago, a new midweek service was suggested out of sort of a little petri dish of leading edge people who said, what would happen if we made a worship service that people from Starbucks would like to come to? We'd make it in the middle of the week, they could come, we'd put it in a circle up in the altar space, we'd clear everything out, we'd just light candles, we'd chant, we would pray, we would do no homilies, each person would step up to the plate and do a little Lectio Divina, we'd respond, we'd do some more chanting, some more quiet, some prayer, then we'd go have soup. So we put it into place. It's now 7 years old. It happens at 6 o'clock at All Saints by the Sea, and it is an amazing thing. As part of that, another plan rose up beside it to examine what goes on with prayer. Out of those initial classes, people were coming over from Trinity because they were intrigued with this. We took a vote, and people wanted to learn about healing prayer. So we decided to take ourselves to school. We are 7 years now in this conjoined project, and it's very slow to develop. We eventually exposed about 150 people through perhaps we ran about maybe 8 workshops between the two churches. So we had good exposure, brought in good healing touch nurses. We brought in the clinical program of highly researched healing touch, and that is what we have been using. We are about 8 to 10 of us now are certified, takes a long time to do that, in healing touch, so that we've developed a very strong model of working with this. It's about to be launched now into various versions for families, for working with shut-ins, etc. But it all works out of this coming into center, into coherence, into the knowledge that when we come into the wholeness of the energy that is threading through the universe, we will automatically experience repair, recreation, restoration, so that as we balance through the body, things just begin to move together like a chant. The impulses begin to weave together in a harmonic. Healing is so well documented now, healing touches, that I'm surprised in many respects it hasn't been picked up by churches. But I think that there are all those old programs of the old story that are distrustful and skeptical. Fortunately, we walked into this from the new story. We walked into it purely through science and some mysticism. So Trinity Church, a clinic is now running for Healing Touch on Friday afternoons. And at All Saints, we believe we'll be running a similar one on Friday morning. So check with us if you're more interested. Thanks, Judith, for the question.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, John.
Your lovely quote at the end is one of the most beautiful mini poems I've come across. And I'd love the audience to know the author, and if you have available the next line or lines to
I haven't put them to memory, John, but of course it's a Rumi quote, which I should have said. Thank you, John. Yeah. And it has just become, you know, one of my favorite quotes of all time, but it has grown in meaning for me as I've begun to understand what the fields are that Rumi may actually be implying. I think he is. John and I spoke briefly during intermission. I think he may be, indeed, referring to a beautiful meadow outside the gates where all this haranguing is going on, but it's actually a meadow of consciousness. It's a meadow of connection. It's a meadow that is always alive. But it is out beyond the dual consciousness, out beyond rightness and wrongness. He's talking about non-duality, that meadow where all life meets.
Bear with me as I try to remember one that I use in my emails sometimes.
Oh, wonderful, please.
And it may not be the full poem. In fact, it may have just been a few phrases out of a larger text. But it goes something like this. Could you repeat the start of it for me?
Out beyond.
Yeah.
Ideas of right doing and wrongdoing. There is a field.
Yes.
I'll meet you there.
Yes.
Ah, Jan's got it.
Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense.
Oh, thank you, Jan. Jan Deppendahl, one of the pillars of the Healing Touch Project. Yes.
Concerning their Healing Touch, I've often wondered why this was. I work as a volunteer in pediatrics at the hospital. And I never knew, understood, but it works. Whenever they have a baby that cries, whatever reason, pain, whatever, if they'll give it to me and I hold it, it stops crying and it just totally relaxes and totally goes to sleep. And you know, you have to wait until they get to a certain level before you can set them down. And they'll let me know, you know, by the reactions on their face,
yes,
whether they want to be let down or not, you know. And sometimes I have to hold them for an hour. But it never fails. They just totally relax. You can tell by the coloration of their face that they're totally safe and perfect. But I wanted to take it one step further, and this may be totally off the wall.
Oh, good.
My my daughter has three dogs. Two of them are perfectly normal. One of them is about six bricks short of a load. When he was born, he caught parvo, which is usually a fatal
and
disease.
And he survived? My.
And he's a Jack Russell. And she paid a fortune to have him healed and brought back. But he did come back, like I say, not totally like his brothers. But whenever I come, whenever I arrive there, he is totally in heaven until I settle down for a nap. He has to have me totally to himself, lies on the bed quietly like a mouse, and lets me pet him, and he's in seventh heaven. At night, he will not go anywhere except where I am asleep. And he'll sleep with me. So I have to sleep in a separate bed from my wife. And when I leave to go home, he cries bitterly in the hallway to the bedroom because I'm going. He sees me walking out of the case. And I don't know whether the two are related, whether he sees in me that I love him, and, you know, like I love all dogs, you know, but I don't know whether they would be related or not with me and animals, or us and animals, or what.
Oh.
Maybe you could tell me it's positive or...
Herbert Benson talks about the relaxation response that happens with meditation. My new hero here has been telling us about the grandfather response. There is something about your field that instantly wraps around and entrains. You are a coherent guy, apparently. Animals and kids never lie. They're infallible. So that whatever is going on there, thank you for it, keep it going. And it's real. Your field is like that coherent heart chart. You just are calming them down. And the way you kind of know about this is not so much in your intellect. but in with the whole holding bodily field of intelligence that you obviously are manifesting, and you're living within. You're already the beginning of an amphibian here. One of my sons is a pediatrician, and he would recognize this story. He would love it. He was a smart kid, a good, fast learner, a whiz in medical school. They wanted him to be a surgeon. He loved kids. He wanted to deal with kids. They thought he was crazy. But his love of children and his way with families, dogs, etc., has slowly deepened. He's not where you are yet, but he walks in as a healing presence now, just the way you do. Can the rest of us learn or emulate? Well, what we can do is the following. We can slow down inside. Our intellect is going quack, 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 quack at 90 miles an hour all the time. Just simply slow it down and turn your attention to the felt quality of whatever is around you. And you will immediately see it in a different way, because you'll begin to feel as well as see. For just an instant, your heart will have entrained your brain, and you will begin to move into a state that is much safer. The parasympathetic state that comes online when we move into coherence is not the one that we work with all the time. We work out of the... John could get up here and do a better job than I am. The sympathetic state, straight state. But that is the one that's always operating out of the reptilian and limbic parts of our brain. We're always on the lookout for safety, etc. When we drop into coherence, it's a no-show fear. And we can't get into trouble, because part of us is always reading the signs all the time that will keep us out of trouble. You are somehow partaking in some manner of that state. We are blessed to have you give us the last word this morning. Thank you. Thank you so much, all of you. I'll see you next week.